President Clinton's foreign policy toward Russia leaves an unclear legacy. The collapse of the Soviet Union coincided with President Clinton's assumption of the presidency. From the beginning, his challenge was how to encourage Russia to abandon its communist past and to join the community of free and democratic nations. But Russia's transformation remains an enigmatic work in progress, and for all the Clinton administration's efforts, Russia's future as a democracy and free market economy remains an open question. In part three of a week-long series on President Clinton's foreign policy record, NPR's Ann Gerrels reports.
For an administration which had made the domestic transformation of Russia the centerpiece of its foreign policy, the results are decidedly mixed. But Michael McFaul, a senior fellow with the Carnegie Endowment, says it's important to remember that the potential nightmare scenarios, a communist resurgence, fascist victory, or military dictatorship, did not happen, and that for all the stops, starts, and crises, there's been progress.
We don't have a thriving market economy and a robust democracy in Russia, but I think looking at it compared to where we were and compared to what could have been, there has been some successes.
Changing Russia proved far harder than the Clinton administration ever dreamt. Deputy Secretary of State Strobe Talbot, the president's chief advisor on Russia, acknowledges much remains unresolved.
Russia doesn't know what it is. There is a casting about going on in Russia for a national idea and a national identity. And some of the ideas being put forward are throwbacks to the bad old days. Others are new ideas that could be, if indulged and institutionalized, dangerous.
The Clinton administration has been assailed for backing President Boris Yeltsin and his cronies as they plundered the country and waged a bloody war against Chechen separatists, which made little distinction between civilians and armed fighters. It's been faulted for rushing through a privatization program which enriched a very few, impoverished the majority, encouraged corruption, and made America unpopular. Talbot argues economic reforms were necessarily brutal.
The alternative would have been gradualism. It would have been letting the old Soviet apparatus and power structure stay in place and trying to take it down a brick at a time. That was an edifice that didn't want to collapse and was only going to collapse if it were knocked down with a wrecking ball.
Most of all, the administration has been accused of ignoring or hiding the truth about Russia's problems, creating an image of success when there really wasn't much to cheer about. Looking back, Stephen Sestanovich, the administration's special ambassador to the newly independent states, says Boris Yeltsin's last 4 years were wasted.
In those wasted years, a lot of work that needed to be done to create a market economy, that didn't happen. Beyond that, the work that should have been done to reform the Soviet state, the police, the intelligence apparatus, the military, that was also either on hold or reversed in some ways.
Strobe Talbot has often said the administration was working in totally uncharted waters, making it up as it went along. If the U.S. learned one lesson, McFaul of Carnegie says it was humility.
We were marginal to Russia's domestic transformation, no matter what we did. It's a sobering reality that we have to get used to, that we were. This was not our revolution, it was their revolution.
Yet while there were certainly some rough patches, President Clinton and President Yeltsin were able to agree on certain basic principles: a free press, free elections, and the sovereignty of Russia's neighbors. Talbot suggests President-elect Bush will face a whole new set of challenges with President Putin.
I'm not 100% sure what Vladimir Putin stands for over the long run, what his game plan for the future of Russia is. We've seen a number of things, such as his crackdown on the free media, which could be ominous in their implications for the future. His tendency to exert a lot of muscle against neighboring states, Georgia in particular, but also Ukraine.
President Clinton hoped Russia would be a friend and ally, but Russia is reluctant to give up its superpower status. And as Talbot notes, the Russia that is emerging could prove uncomfortable for the United States.
There is, on the part of some Russian leaders, a geopolitical temptation to support any country which is at odds with the United States, precisely because it is at odds with the United States, kind of in the spirit of replaying the great game or geopolitical counterbalancing of the U.S.
The Bush administration has said it's going to focus on security issues with immediate attention directed at safeguarding Moscow's nuclear forces and stockpile, always a tricky subject. It can expect Russian opposition to continued expansion of NATO, and Russia will join forces with Europeans to fight a new anti-missile defense system. But Russia welcomes President-elect Bush's proposals for both sides to make deep cuts in their nuclear arsenals, something the Clinton team was unable to achieve. Ambassador Sestanovich calls this a positive move.
It reflects something that actually hasn't been done over the 10 years since the breakdown of the Soviet Union, and that is to really put the strategic relationship on a completely different footing.
But Sestanovich warns against focusing on strategic issues alone. Russia's no longer the emergency case it was 8 years ago, thanks in large part to high oil prices. There's sufficient growth that it can now handle a lot of its own problems. And if Moscow was once desperate for outside aid and advice, it no longer wants the West meddling in its affairs. But it still needs international credits. It must still service its old debts. The revolution is far from complete. Ambassador Sestanovich says President-elect Bush is finding out Russia is much more than the sum of its nukes.
The reasons for thinking that American interests will be affected by what happens in Russia are deeper than that. They first of all go to the future of all of the states, other states of the former Soviet Union, because what happens to them, whether they remain independent states, whether they become democratic states, is going to depend to a very large extent on what happens in Russia.
In addition to the IMF and other financial institutions, there's a whole network of international organizations which the Russians say they want to be part of. The Non-Proliferation Regime, the World Trade Organization, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, just to name a few. But to be integrated into the West, to be a member in good standing, requires more domestic reforms. These are steps the Russians themselves have to take. But Michael McFaul of Carnegie says Russia has yet to be persuaded it can and wants to be part of the West.
What concerns me in focusing more on strategic issues is that they lose sight of the fact that Russian integration into the West still should be an objective. And if we lose sight of that, the danger is that you can go back to a kind of realpolitik, balance of power, I would even say Cold War mentality between U.S. and Russia.
While Russia will not go back to the way it once was, it is nonetheless at a crossroads. In many ways, it's the age-old Russian argument. Should it continue to push to be part of the West, or should it say, we don't want to be part of your clubs, and go its own way? The romance and chumminess of the Clinton-Yeltsin years are gone. Both sides are now looking at the relationship much more in terms of cost-benefit. That will make it easier and more difficult for the Bush administration. Anne Garrels, NPR News, Moscow.